outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Well, I got a bit of a bone to pick with you, Kyle.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Yeah, I thought about this last week when we were recording, but then Sarah really caught it while we were listening to the recording later.
Okay.
We begin the podcast with Back in Your Era. That's a little extreme, right? Like it wasn't horse and buggy days.
Had they not created the wheel yet?
You and I may not be in the same generation. We're definitely in the same era. I don't want to hear that Back in Your Era stuff ever again.
That's interesting. I'll have to see what I can do about that.
And I would know these things being twice as old as you.
I was going to say, I don't want to age shame you. I don't want to have to go down that road. So
you don't have to age shame me. I don't mind that. But it's that Back in Your Era thing. Then Sarah said, you know, I thought about that too when we were recording it. And I didn't take a shot at him. So I'll do it next week. So this is next week. Well, we've made it to Denver, Colorado, or the area around there. Mm-hmm. And visit our son, last leg of the trip. So be on our way home next week and looking forward to seeing if our house still stands.
How do you feel about landing back in Southern California? Is this going to be a good transition back home? Like,
yeah, I think we're both ready to get home, but okay. I could go another month out here. I'm not chomping at the bit to get home, but
yeah,
I think we're both ready to have a little more space to shave and shower in the morning.
That's fair.
And I think the puppy is really done. I think we've had demon dog mode the last few days. I think she's just been cooped up or leashed far too long. She just needs to romp. She's going over to my son's house this afternoon. She's in the backyard, big fenced in backyard. Just yep. run your tail off, little puppy. We have noticed on this trip, though, and I'm not claiming any godly nothing by this, but everywhere we've gone for the first part of this trip, the really bad problem-causing weather was about 2 weeks behind us.
Okay.
Whenever we left a place, we would notice that the severe thunderstorms and flooding and whatnot would come through.
Uh-huh.
And now on the way back, we were noticing as we were getting toward Missouri and Kansas, there were major, major storms out there. And part of Sarah's trigger for her trauma is lightning and thunderstorms that really send her into PTSD. And there was one we were going to have to drive through it one day. And this big storm kind of, I watched it on the radar, split in two. And our route was right between where the storms went. We had one kind of night where we had some bit of lightning and thunder. But for the most part, it's been amazing how we've kind of dodged the bad stuff.
Ooh, that's pretty nice. Glad to hear that. Instead of you needing a staff, your RV just parts the storms instead of the waves.
I'm not claiming any divine intervention, but we're both just really grateful because wherever storms missed us, they battered other people who may have the same situation Sarah does, right? So
yeah.
I don't know how to kind of deal with that other than to say we're really, really grateful that however we routed this, it has missed the bulk of the bad weather. It's been easy to drive until we got to Colorado roads. And then, man, Colorado is the worst roads in the entire United States of the places we've traveled. Now, North Dakota may be worse. I don't know. We haven't been there. But,
okay,
man, from the time we crossed from Kansas into Colorado, it just, it's incredible. It's still, wow. This is the interstate. You think the interstate at least have some kind of continuity in terms of road quality? No, not even close. And
no.
We know it's already bad leaving here, going up over the Rockies to get on home. We know it's bad there. It knocked our microwave out of its position last time. We had to come back and have it bolted into the sidewall so it wouldn't fall out again. Yeah. Crazy. But so we got that to look forward to on Monday as we head back home.
Okay. And no stops, though. You're shooting straight back to Southern California.
Well, yeah, well, there'll be stops at night to sleep, but yeah,
yes.
we're not doing meetings, anything like that. We're not doing much here in Denver. We've not a few individual people have asked for some time, so we've grabbed that, but we've not done any kind of meeting thing.
And you're in Golden, right?
We're in Golden, Colorado. Clear Creek is about 15 feet off my back window.
Okay.
We're backed right up against, there's a pathway. People walk, people come streaming all day long through here. It's beautiful. And the river's just running crazy, crazy rapids. Anyway, I'm Wade Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. And I'm going to take a break next week. We may have something special. We may not, but I'm going to take a break since we're driving home and won't be recording. So come listening next week. Maybe you'll get something. Maybe you know. We'll have to see. So what's the best thing you heard this week, Mr. Kyle?
Oof. I think this will help us transition into some of the things I want to explore today. But I was listening to a book by Brené Brown, and one of the quotes that came up that I absolutely loved, and it just kind of paused me and I was laughing about, is that we are not fit for human consumption when we are in shame. I was laughing at that. We are not fit for relational human consumption when we are in shame. And I was chuckling that yesterday.
And yet someone in shame needs human connection.
They do. Absolutely. I just think, again, and we can explore this a little bit more, but that when we're in shame, it activates the exact same center of the brain, our exact same parts of the brain as trauma does. Yep. And so when we're in shame, we are in fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. There is no actual relational building that's taking place. And so we got to figure out how we move out of shame and develop some shame resilience in order to be able to navigate that. But I love that when I am in shame, I am not fit for human consumption.
So what do you do? Crawl into a rock somewhere and avoid human contact?
It just depends on the person and how they work out of that. Some people need to talk. Some people need to go for a walk. Some people disconnect in a variety of different ways. But I have to take some pause. I have to take a step back. I need to disconnect myself from that situation. And then usually I need to actually talk to somebody. I need to call it for what it is. And I need to talk out, okay, this is why I'm feeling shame. This is why it activated me. And then do some reality checking of, is that actually true or not? So,
yeah. Kurt Thompson's book, The Anatomy of Shame, that Sarah and I read, gosh, six, seven years ago now. He talks about how much goes offline in the brain, the ability of the brain to put it, I think, 11 different centers that need to coordinate for an effective way to live. And all that goes offline when shame hits.
Really?
Yeah. And it's fascinating. It's why when you get really, really embarrassed in a conversation or situation, you can't think of a thing to say. You can't think of a thing to do because the parts of your brain that form language that do things like that go offline. They just don't get any blood. So
there's
no way to construct a conversation. And we noticed some of that with one of Sarah's trauma symptoms going on is sometimes there are certain parts of her brain go offline, and we've learned to just kind of enjoy that. Like particularly she's navigating the RV while I'm driving, and I can see it in her eye that somehow it's all piled up and she's looking at her computer, but nothing is, it's just not connecting. And
Yeah.
So we've learned to just enjoy the moment, and then I'm on my own, and hopefully I don't get this thing trapped somewhere that I can't get out of. but it's interesting to know how much this stuff that so helped me, because for years we've noticed that at times, and it was like Sarah can't think of what to say or whatever. Well, I've never in my life not had anything to say about anything. So I'm just like, what do you mean? You don't have anything to say. And now to see it's actually a physiological reality. That's been incredibly helpful to us. And then it becomes part of the reality you swim in. And we can laugh at it when it happens. And we can just say, we can't do anything about it. We just got to navigate our way through it. And
Jess and I navigated something very similar, because mine will go offline. My ability to say something or come up with an idea will go offline when depending on the type of situation that we're in and the conversation that we're having. And initially Jess was like, early on in our marriage, like, why aren't you communicating with me? Why won't you talk? Like, you're just walking away. And it's like, I need to, because I literally can't say anything. Like, physiologically, I cannot respond to you right now. Like, there's no possible way for me to do that. So if you want me to communicate, you have to let me be able to step away, because I'm not going to be able to say anything.
Yeah. For someone like me, that's just so hard to believe. It is, because I just have never had trouble having words about stuff. They have not always been helpful words, but I have words. I don't lose that. That doesn't disintegrate for me for some reason.
Gotcha. So best thing you heard this week?
You know, I'm gonna trump you on the Brené Brown thing, because I'm gonna go to scripture because I'm more holy and all.
Fair enough.
That was really the context for this, honestly. We've just been with a couple parents who lost kids to suicide. And I was carrying that part of my prayer time with God, carrying the agony. And when I encounter suffering, whether it's my own or other people's, I kind of carry that with God. And I was just really thinking about the loss of, as a parent, what it would be like to lose a child, especially to suicide. And these were two kids, and these were not people who even knew each other or related. They're two different cities.
Really?
But both of them, the kids, were crying out to God for help and didn't feel like they got it, and at least by the parents' observation in the aftermath. Yeah. And so I was holding that, just a generation that's racked by depression, confused by sexuality, and being destroyed by suicide. And I just was carrying that. And then Sarah and I read this in Jeremiah 24:7, and I will give them a heart to know me. They'll be my people, and I will be their God, for they will have returned to me with all their hearts. And Jeremiah is actually saying this about the children of Israel going into Jerusalem. He's saying the leaders that brought all this on, they're going to be destroyed. But those who go away, I'm going to care for them. I'm going to be kind to them. I'm going to protect them. And I'm going to give them a heart to know me. And when I read that, I began to pray that for this generation of younger folks in the world. And I feel like I just even want to say, not only for me, that's a prayer of mine now.
Yeah.
But I would love for some of the people in my generation who have some space in your life and prayer time to begin to pray that for the younger generations, that they would have a heart to know God, that God would give them that, not that they need to come up with it.
Yeah.
But God would give them that. And I feel like that's something on God's heart. Kind of a couple of years ago, we were talking about the return to innocence. We're talking about protecting a new generation. It doesn't have to be like teenagers. It could be in the 30s and 40s, even of people who have never seen a God worth loving. The God they've been given by our culture and by our religious culture and by many Christian groups is judgmental and angry and always lusting for more power and always threatening people. They don't know a God who can walk into the deepest point of their despair and hold them in love.
Yeah.
And I want to invite some other folks, seriously, to maybe just put this down as something you want to carry. And I don't mean just make a prayer request. That used to be, okay, so God, I ask you to give him a heart. And now what? Do I keep asking him every day? Do I keep repeating the same thing? Is this a mantra? And if I say it enough times, if enough people say it, then God will do it. I think all this stuff's crazy talk. But I do think there's a way to just say, okay, God, give them a heart to know you. How does that happen in them? Put some young people in your heart that you know and ask God on their behalf and their generation to reveal himself, to hold that, to ask God if there's any prayer you have in that. And then like hold that over months, not the day or two or a week or two. And if you want to kind of come on this journey with me, I would love to have some people that would hold that in their hearts. Because I do think that the heart to know God is something he gives, that desire. And I think Jesus is wanting to rescue a generation that's being lost. So that was the best thing I heard this week, because I've been living on that ever since.
Man, a couple of things that really come up to my mind when I hear you say that. First of all, man, I love that prayer. And I think that the beauty of it is that I already see God's living and active and doing it. That's the wild thing, is when you said that, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I see it. I see his fingerprint on that. I see that movement taking place. And the intriguing part, though, and we've talked about this a little bit in some previous episodes, the idea of being a listener and a learner. Because I don't know if people come with the traditional religious ears, I don't think they're going to hear Father's heart stirring these young people, or this stirring up this longing, this desire, this hunger to know God's heart. I think they might miss it, because I've been hearing it a lot recently, which I love that you bring this up, because I've been hearing it a lot. And yet where it's coming from and the conversation that it's surrounding, the language that they're using, the way that they're bringing it up, the conversation pieces that they're highlighting, it's not traditional Christianese by any means.
No, I think that that's really good. I think because many of them have rejected the Christian presentation of God.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That when they begin to encounter that presence, they may call it something else. Mm-hmm. They may call him something. They may call it the voice of the universe or something, you know, some grand creator thing that's not the language we like to hear from people who've been down the Roman road and said the sinner's prayer and jumped in a tub and got baptized and all that stuff. And I think it's recognizing how God is making himself known. And it may not be, he's not first, I am Jesus, so here's the rules. It's going to be just a tender voice in their heart that's inviting them into something lovable. And I had a time this morning with a couple that we actually from California, but we met them. I met them in Golden this morning. They happened to be in town and said, hey, we'd really love to connect with you. So I walked up there and just had a little bit of time with them today. Yeah. And we were talking about their move out of a more legalistic version of Christianity, mm-hmm. A pretty severe one, not your normal thing, but even worse. And as we were talking about that, we were talking about how we treat sinners, how we treat people in sin. And one of the ways we do that is we don't treat them as if they're lovable.
Mm.
When love is the only thing that will win them into freedom. And I love that we landed on that in the conversation today, that to see people that we'd normally, ooh, that's disgusting, or turn our nose up. Some of the kids that are really confused in so many ways, sexually or in their sexuality or the way they view the universe or politically or whatever that cause offense with us. When we lose the sense that someone lost is lovable, we'll lose the capacity to love them. And if they get the idea that they're not lovable by the crowd who knows Jesus, then they're not going to be able to be loved by him. And it was a neat discovery. I think we all made it together while we're sitting at this table of just, wow, I want to see people trapped in darkness as lovable, more lovable, not less lovable, not when you get your life together, maybe there'll be a way to love you, but to find an endearing relationship with people trapped in things that I may not agree with or may find even a bit disgusting. I can lose all that and just see the person underneath who's trapped by whatever illusion, lied, sin, whatever, as a lovable person marred by the darkness.
It makes me even think of what Sarah said a couple of weeks ago that was my best thing I heard last week of they need a free pass for love.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that there's not this list of accountability of, oh, you know, you need to adjust your behavior here, or you need to do this, or you need to jump through these hoops in order to experience the unconditional love of God. It's like, no, they are desperate for that. And I think about that, and especially this generation, and it's like, man, the lack of sense of purpose, the lack of sense of meaning, the lack of human connection. The idea of connection and belonging. And I was listening to some research the other day, and it was talking about how if people do not feel connected and feel like they have a sense of belonging, of unconditional belonging in a space, if they're void of that, there is always deep suffering associated with it. Because of our innate design and need for connection, both with the humanity around us and, I believe, for the God that created us.
That's where apologetics didn't serve us well. And we're talking way back now in the maybe late 60s, early 70s, where we put a lot of our Christian energy into this logical apologetic for what's true. And the lie was that the truth will bring people to love.
Mm.
And it didn't. I think what I've come to learn over the trajectory of my life is love is the conduit to truth. If someone knows they're loved and knows that they're safe inside a relationship, they'll be more open to what's true. Mm. And what's true is not necessarily, okay, now I can give them the doctrine of the church. No, what's true is, how does God see them? How do they see themselves? How do they navigate a fallen creation with a living God? It's that what's true, not a list of doctrinal agreements you got to have to be a good Christian.
Yeah.
If someone being lovable and me finding the connection with them, even if no one else does, because I think we've got to kids committing suicide, and you've got people who feel completely lost, completely alone, mm-hmm. and no hope of anything changing.
Yeah.
And I think many times they've lost that sense of belonging. And if we could help people discover their lovability, their mm-hmm. worthiness of love, like even the couple we met with, one thing, the husband wanted to contact me about maybe getting together. She had some things she wanted to share. And she was like, yeah. We're not worthy of his time. We're not worthy of that. And we're sitting there. She goes, and yet here we are. Because it's a strange way to think. But I think mm-hmm. that's kind of the overlay of religion on our lives, is we mm-hmm. decide if we're worthy or not of God's goodness, the favor line that we didn't, he loves me, the tyranny of the favor line, where if I'm good enough, then may I get God's love. And if I'm not good enough, then I've got to deal with his wrath, instead of, no, God loves us all. And that love's trying to rescue us from darkness. And if I can let him love me and recognize that love giving birth in my heart, and if I can help other people recognize that, that will open the way to light. But love comes first. And people being lovable, and even when people we love are being hurtful to us, or their darkness is acting out in ways that are painful to us, if you can handle that pain, stay in the relationship, because love is the only hope they have. So yeah, that has touched my heart this week a lot. I hope enough people catch a flavor of what that might look like, and just live your day more aware of who around you may need some real love and belonging today without earning it.
It's intriguing, the response to the word love. So I was in a meeting just the other day. I'm going to do some consulting with a company, and part of what they're wanting to do is they're wanting to integrate strengths into their corporate culture. And what I introduced them to the idea of some of the Jamie Winship stuff of, okay, that's fine. Like, we can do strengths and we can kind of explore that and whatnot, but it has to be founded, it needs to flow through the perception or the understanding of a love-based identity. And yet here I am, I'm sitting with a director or a room full of C-level directors. So all these are the high-end people of this corporation. It was interesting to watch the tangible influence of bringing up the word love or a love-based identity in a corporate environment. And even myself responding of, oh, like, can I use the word love in a corporate environment? Can I use that terminology in a corporate environment? Well, yes, absolutely. But what was the internal resistance to even bringing up the word love in an environment that desperately needs it? I mean, if there's a place that needs the kingdom love to saturate, it's corporate culture, it's career culture in general. And so, but man, there was some intriguing resistance both in myself. And then when I used that word, they were fine with fear. So when I talked about fear-based identity, they're like, oh yeah, we can resonate with that. But they could connect with wholehearted. They were resistant to love. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, two things came to mind when you're talking about. Number one is, they're probably not people who know love. Because if you're at the COO, CEO, CFO level of something, you have achieved that by performance. And that performance has often been in deference to love. I can either care about you, I can get you to do the work I need you to do to make me successful, or make the corporation successful. And yeah. I think, just like even in a religious setting, or in a, we talk about love all the time. Mm-hmm. But love is tough to implement when you're trying to accomplish things where it's not about love. It's about your character on the stage. It's about how you present yourself. It's about performance. And do you meet a minimum level of morality to justify your presence on our stage? Mm-hmm. Everything is about performance. And I think when you start talking about love, you go, okay, that's the opposite. I don't know how to bring love and actually care about this person I have to fire tomorrow, or I have to get more performance for them, or I'm going to have to fire them. I think that's probably the threat. And to particularly upper level executives who probably aren't comfortable with the love conversation outside the workplace,
Yes. So
inside the workplace is even more disturbing. Oh, crud. I've just got the performance down. I'm going to have to like love my subordinates or love my peers. And I think that's wonderfully threatening.
It was, I mean, honestly, Wade, it was so intriguing to feel the shift in the room, because there's two individuals, the two individuals that actually invited me to come and work with this corporation and to do this training with them. Both of them, I know, operate out of a space of love in their environments. I've watched them do it. I've worked alongside of them. I've seen them live it out. But it was intriguing to watch some of the physiological reactions to, where is he going with this? Is this getting sappy? Is this like, are we talking romantic? Like, how is romantic love going to be viable in the workplace? It's like, whoa, no, hold on a second. No.
I did that by HR.
Yeah, exactly. Is this a violation with HR just to have this conversation, right? And yet, when we were talking about love before, and you were talking about like the religious perspective of love, I feel like we have to start with love. We have to start with that deep, that heart understanding of the fact that we are loved before I think. I think that is the birthplace of truth, right? Until I had the lens, the encounter, the perspective of, I am fully seen in all of my mess, and I am fully loved and accepted here at the same time. That was what set me on a completely different life trajectory. Mm-hmm. When I had that counseling experience, and yet that was the doorway for truth, revelation, understanding, healing to come into my life, was to start with love. That was the original experience of truth that I had to start with before anything else could be added to it.
And I think people see a conflict between love and power. In the sense that if I'm going to love somebody, love is a soft, mamby-pamby, let them get away. Mm-hmm. I don't, when you see the love of God, which is fully seen, fully known, fully loved, but also invited into life, invited into something more than just, oh, it's okay, I understand. No, I understand. I also want to rescue you from the places you got lost. And there's no, I mean, I talk about loving like a wayward teenager for parents or whatever. And it's the first immediate thing is just, oh, so I just soft let them do whatever they want. I mean, okay, does God's love let you do whatever you want? I mean, it will let you, but it doesn't mean it's good for you and that God won't be inviting you to something else. Love can be incredibly firm. It doesn't have to be manipulative in the sense that I need to manipulate you to get what I want, but it can be very firm in saying, listen, I really care about you. I want to make you successful here every way I can, but this is what we need to work on together if we're going to make that happen. And if you're not willing to work on that with me, at some point, your job here is at risk. You can do that in a loving way. That's not the opposite of love, but I think a lot of people think it is, that love is soft, it's weak. Because we all know that you could fix Israel and Gaza today if you had love. If both sides loved each other, it would be over. We'd stop destroying all the lives around us because we're existentially at risk from the other side.
Yeah.
But that just seems like such a pipe. I think that's where our world just goes, that's a pipe dream. That's never going to happen. So we got to get more bombs and more wars, and we've got to protect ourselves by blowing things up. And I don't wonder that managers of large corporations at some point have to say, I mean, they're chasing, I don't know if they're publicly traded, but you're chasing some motive, whether it's a profit motive or accountability to shareholders. And you don't get rewarded by shareholders for there's more love in our organization, right? Yeah. It's more profit, more bottom line. And I think in a bottom line culture, this is where love is really tricky, to create the environment that genuinely loves without being weak.
See, and it's interesting, because the note that I wrote down as you were talking about is that God is not firm enough with an exclamation point. That's the way that we perceive it. And that's why we start to move into our own control, right? Like, because, well, God's love isn't getting it done the way that we want it, or it's not controlling that person from going into the weeds or making these poor life decisions or not accepting the invitation to life. And so now we're going to come in and we're going to create structure, whether that is this corporate structure, religious structure, educational structure. We're going to buy more bombs so that we can do it our way, so that we can say, oh no, we're firm enough. We're in our love. Our love is activating enough because of us using our own control in order to make this happen, versus actually embracing some of the scandalousness of the way that God loves, right? Because it's not controlling. It's not manipulative. It does not trespass on the heart. It is an invitation, absolutely, but...
Yeah, because when you talk about structures, now you're going to get to a conformity-based reality at some level.
Yep.
And conformity is the opposite of love.
Yes.
So it's very difficult to know how this operates in our human mechanisms that are designed to mitigate the damage of flesh. You don't want a selfish person in your company wrecking havoc or doing his own thing. So there's got to be reward, punishment kinds of things. So anything institutional, whether it's a business or religion, becomes eventually a conformity-based reality. But how do you get love inside of that? That's the real trick for me, because I think that's why I tend to do a minimum of conformity-based issues, because then you don't have people free to do what they need to do. If I'd come at Sarah when she was gone from a conformity-based platform, look, you promised to be my wife, and you committed to these things, and now you've lied and deceived me. If I'd gone her that way, we'd still be apart.
Yeah.
One of the things that God kind of prepared me for in those weeks that she was gone was to let her come at her terms, but we're not a corporation. I could lose everything giving Sarah all the space to come back or not. Like when you first came out there, the only thing you want to talk about was grandkid activities.
Yeah.
And that's all we talked about, because God had prepared my heart not to. I mean, I had her at a table with you. I'm like, why'd you leave me the letter? What are you doing? How come? What do you mean when you say this? That's not even true. I mean, there's all the things I could have said.
Yeah.
But God had invited me. I used to say God invited me to the powerless position of not trying to drive anything. I'm just providing. I let Sarah know I miss you. I care about you. If you want to do anything about coming back, I'm here for you. But I didn't push my agenda with her, right?
Yeah.
And that seems powerless. But I actually think when you have the freedom not to control the outcome, go back to that Jamie Winship thing where he says if identity is staked to the outcome of a circumstance, you're worthless in it. And certainly, it's not quite how he said it, but that's the way I would say it. I look at that with Sarah. My identity as a husband, my identity as someone helping other people and other marriages, I had everything at risk in my marriage imploding or my wife committing suicide or all that was at risk. But you know what? I didn't care. Sarah's going to come back. She's going back at her term. I don't care what judgments people make of me with this going on. I want her safe, her protected. But that's easier to do when you don't depend on an outcome. And even whether she came back or not, that my identity in Christ, if she came back, that would be the joy of my life. If she didn't come back, I knew God had a way forward for her and me. I would pray for her blessing as well as I would look for what would be for me in the aftermath of not having Sarah here. And I think that's a more powerful position. It's the powerless place in terms of how humanity sees it. To me, that's the cross. Jesus saying, I'm taking everything you dish out. I'm taking it all right here. So come at me with all of it. And I'm taking it. And that is the most powerful place to be, because his assurance was, this is back to control that you were just talking about. I don't have to control the outcome here, because I have God, and God has a way of making right whatever gets exploded. And I love that. I love that freedom, even in this trip we've been on, to just go with the wind. And well, it's a weekend, it's a bad weekend, people that really would have been here can't be here, but we didn't try to drive all around to fit every we went like the wind. If you were free that weekend we were there, then we figured that's what God had in mind. And if you weren't, then God didn't have that in mind, and that's okay with us. So not having an outcome that you have to have, gives you more power in the relationship because you can let them come on their terms. I don't know how you apply that in corporate America. That's your contract.
Well, and I think that's for me, that's a huge heart passion though. I was talking with my dean the other day and she was like, Kyle, if you were going to continue on in education, what would you want to do? Like, what would you want to explore? What would you want to do? And my immediate response was, I would want to go back and get my doctorate in organizational psychology, because one of the two primary places that are so pivotal in our lives are our workplace and education. And yet I was listening to a statistic the other day from some of Brené Brown's research, and she, in her research, she found that over 85% of the people that she interviewed and were in her various studies over the last decade of her work, over 85% could point to a significant situation that occurred in an educational environment that had a negative impact on their identity. There was a significantly altering encounter that was shame-based, et cetera, trauma-based, that was facilitated in an educational environment. So my daughter is going to spend 12, 13 years, 14 years in this educational experience.
And that's before college.
That's before college, correct. Yeah, yeah. So it can't go like the love of the kingdom, kingdom principle, kingdom truth, but kingdom love first and foremost is desperately needed in that environment. And then after they graduate from college or after they graduate from high school and they go out to work in the world, where else? I mean, where else do we not need kingdom love more than in career corporate environment? And I know that there's some major opposing forces that are taking place there, because like you said, there's the bottom line, there's the drivers that, and yet if we continue down the road of a scarcity mentality, a scarcity worldview, I don't know how much more success our economy is going to be able to have if we continue down that road.
I agree with it, but my heart, when you were talking about a negative experience, their identity in a corporate setting or
educational setting. Yep.
Yeah. How true would that also be of the corporate congregation, religious institution? Yeah. I talked to, on this trip, I probably talked to someone every day whose identity was severely compromised in Christ by their participation in a religious community.
Yeah.
That would do the same thing, gave them a very negative message about you and who you are and how God feels about you. Because that's how we trade the manipulation factor in a conformity-based religious structure. Yep. And that's why people say you're against structure. I'm not against structure. I'm against structure that leans toward conformity, not structure that leads to transformation. And there's a big difference between those two things. Mm. And I don't think most people consider the difference, because most people think by reading scripture and applying what it says, that's how I live the Christian life. Instead of, no, I'm not capable of that. Apart from me, you can do nothing. I need a transformational journey in a loving, safe environment to discover who I really am and who he really is. And then I can see the areas of my life that rob me of wholeheartedness because of my selfishness, my flesh, whatever. And now I've got Jesus inside of that, unraveling the things that tend toward my own destruction that I'm not even aware of. And that has to happen in a very different environment from, here's the principles, do the principles, work. And if you don't, you're a failure. You're not committed enough. And those are the things we've often said to people who have underachieved spiritually. And even that word ought to make us quiver, right?
Yeah.
Underachieved spiritually. We make them feel like less than, broken people, not serious disciples, whatever. And all it meant was they weren't able to pretend well enough to fit into the system where everybody else is pretending.
Yeah.
And that leads to that same negative message about their identity and really their impression of God that will overlay the rest of their life if they don't begin to find a different expression of how Jesus makes himself known to them. It's not just applying scriptures to be an obedient life. It's how to engage God in a way that I want to follow him through the things that he wants to do in my life as a beloved child, not to become a beloved child.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would have stories too of the opposite of that, where someone in the educational system helped them find an identity that was transformative to them.
Yes. That saved their, literally saved their life. Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why his invitation is so true. When Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, that life and life to the full is found in me and found in my Father's kingdom. Whether it's in Christianity or it's in the education system or it's in the politics or it's in corporate world environment and corporate culture, kingdom is where life is to be found. That is where genuine life is offered. And so, if you have a religious institution, and I mean, that's when it gets really tricky, because it's got his brand, it's got his name on it. It even has his language, his words that are being used, but they're being skewed and twisted and distorted to the point that they're robbing people of life, right? I mean, the accusation of the Pharisees, like you're burdening them with more chains. You're chaining them up and putting them in a greater level of captivity than they were before. Good job.
and you're shaming them for not living up to your expectations. Yes. Yeah. It's the law all over again. Christianity has incorporated, it's again, talking this morning, we don't realize there's a vast difference between being a practitioner of a religion called Christianity, even a good one, and experiencing the life of Jesus.
Yeah.
Because you can take the words of scripture and twist them any way you want to make anything that you want true. You can pretend to conform to it and miss that. The guy who wrote me from Australia a few months ago and talked about the weaponization of truth instead of the embodiment of truth with a capital T. We were called to embrace the truth of God inside the love of God to a world who's lost. Yeah. And instead, we create a system that demands their conformity against their inability to conform without presence, without Jesus in them, leading, guiding, showing, inviting. Yeah. And so maybe not only for youth, but for all of us, give us a heart to know you, God, so that my desires are in you. My heart is to know you so that you can be my God and I can be your child and live on this planet against the chaos of darkness inside the love and light of God who is at work in us. And man, if you can find a way to apply that to corporate culture, Kyle, get on it, dude. That'd be awesome.
Working on it. I mean, that's the thing. It's just exploring it. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see what love takes on in that context. Maybe there's a better word, like a compassionate. I know that Bush tried that back in the 2000s about a compassionate conservatism, but the idea of compassion, like people struggle with self-love as a thing. When you talk self-compassion, it opens doors because it's self-compassion makes more sense. Self-love sounds selfish to people who struggle with it.
Well, and I think that's why they resonated so quickly with wholehearted versus love. Yes. Right? A wholehearted based identity versus a love based identity. They're like, oh, I can get behind a wholehearted one, you know, but love, there's so many connotations there. I don't know what we're going to do with that.
And yet we all desire to be loved.
Yeah.
To the core of our being, to be seen, to be known, to be loved for who we are, to know that we're lovable, and especially in the darkness, to know that we're lovable.
Yes.
So that God can walk us out.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.